the great arranger, composer, and bandleader Oliver Nelson with Screamin' the Blues, the title track of his 1961 album. Of course, Oliver Nelson on tenor, and he also plays alto on this. Eric Dolphy on bass, clarinet, and alto sax as well. Richard Williams on trumpet. Richard Wyons on piano. George Duvivier on bass. And Roy Haynes, one of my favorite drummers. And that fills out a group of extraordinary sidemen laying the groundwork for an extraordinary musician. This is Lead Stories. I'm Mutrice Lead. And today we have a program that it's going to be packed with a lot of information. So you will want to listen very attentively. And of course, you know that we always have these programs archived so you can go back to it at any time you wish. The program is about bad medicine and big money. A blistering, just concluded congressional report on the operations of the Clinton Health Access Initiative, the highest revenue generating project of the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation that was spun off as its own nonprofit in 2010, charges that the former president's much vaunted HIV/AIDS relief program distributed watered down and adulterated medications to patients in sub-Saharan Africa and in cash-strapped countries where the initiative, the program called CHAI, was welcomed as a godsend for people with HIV/AIDS. The 78-page report initiated by Representative Marsha Blackburn, a Republican from Tennessee, and endorsed by some 64 members of Congress, was delivered to the Inspectors General of the Health and Human Services Department and the Department of State, asking for further probes into CHAI, the Clinton Foundation, and how former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and the State Department helped to facilitate highly questionable business dealings to benefit the Clinton philanthropic conglomerate. Nationally renowned investigative reporter and author Richard Pollack, who broke the story about the congressional report, joins us now to explain its details and its likely impact, and also Charles Ortel. You recognize him. He has been our guide and expert on the Clinton Foundation, and he's going to be talking also about the largest unprosecuted charity fraud in U.S. history, as he claims. Gentlemen, good to have you with us today.
Good morning, or good afternoon.
Thank you, Richard.
Pleasure.
Richard Pollack is a senior investigative reporter for the Daily Call the News Foundation. Previously, he won an Emmy as the Washington producer for ABC's Good Morning America, and later served as the senior producer for Fox News Sunday and the Washington bureau chief for PJTV. He has done investigative reporting for the Progressive Magazine, The Village Voice, and The Washington Examiner. But you filed one heck of a story, which I read, and you accompanied it, I guess, with the 78-page report for those wishing to look into the details of it. But what is this report about, and why is it so devastating?
Well, I think, first of all, the Clinton Foundation and one of its active parts, the Clinton Health Access Initiative, that worked on trying to alleviate AIDS or HIV/AIDS in third world countries, developing countries. This project has been hailed by almost everyone. It is perhaps the signature success story by the Clinton Foundation. A lot of people felt that it encapsulated the compassion that both former President Clinton and Hillary Clinton had toward victims of this terrible disease. So it comes as a total shock to discover that apparently millions of packets of drugs that were distributed by the foundation, by the Clinton Foundation, were adulterated. That is, they were diluted or watered down, and they did not have the potency that both the healthcare workers that were giving the medicine or the patients expected. We do not know how many millions of people may have been adversely affected by the use of this adulterated drug, but it is not only a tragedy, it's and shocking, but it's something where you just feel as if there needs to be some accountability for this action. I might mention this all came to the public's attention about 10 years ago when the World Health Organization and the Food and Drug Administration began sending out warning letters to the manufacturer of the company. It's an Indian company, that is a company in India, named Ranbaxy. And this company began to receive a whole range of warning letters about the inadequacy of the quality control measures in two of their its three plants. And in those two plants, the HIV drugs were manufactured. And finally, it resulted in a plea of guilty of seven counts of falsifying data, fraudulently providing data to the U.S. government, and also for defrauding the U.S. government, as well as many states that use the generic drugs themselves from Ranbaxy. So that is an overview of it. I'll stop there. As you said, it's a fact-packed kind of story, and but one that's very sad and very chilling.
When you're an investigative reporter, when you saw sub-Saharan Africa and adulterated or watered-down HIV-AIDS drugs and the Clinton Foundation and its health initiative, its health access initiative, and you saw also Ranbaxy, what immediately clicked in your mind?
Well, I have to tell you, there were a number of investigations by federal agencies, the Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Agency for International Development, the World Health Organization, and I was just shocked. I mean, I just couldn't believe that this track record was there, and also it's been out in the open to a certain extent, and none of us knew it. None of us knew about it until this congressional report came out just this week.
Now, the Clinton Health Access Initiative was a part of an integrated part of the Clinton Foundation, and then it was spun off into its own independent entity. Why do you think that happened?
Well, I'll actually let Charles Ortel, who is on your program as well, to address that. But this was a very large program, and it probably took up at least 60% of the revenues that the Clinton Foundation actually was providing. However, there was one other important element. In 2010, well, actually in 2008, Hillary Clinton was about to become the Secretary of State, and there was supposed to be a reduction or an arm's length relationship between the Clinton Foundation and foreign governments, including donations from foreign governments. And a large number of international organizations and foreign governments gave money to CHAI. And this is probably what led to the decision in 2009 and then executed in 2010 to try to separate the Clinton Health Access Initiative from the Clinton Foundation. I think, as Charles will probably tell you much better than I can, this particular separation was a bit bogus. He can talk about the legal problems of trying to separate it. But I think that there was a very, very small effort to try to give the appearance that there were fewer foreign donations being given to the charity at the time.
Well, we'll get to Charles in just one second. I just want to say that the report seems to suggest, while it is concentrating in this particular instance on the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Health Access Initiative, CHAI, in sub-Saharan Africa. It seems to me, because I read the report, it seems that there than that to include the Caribbean as well. In Africa, there's a question about the efficacy of these adulterated drugs in Botswana, Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Guyana,
Hello, I'm losing you for a moment there. I just lost you for a moment, Eutrice. Hello?
I can hear you.
Okay, I'm here.
Okay, I can hear you now. That's I'm sorry, Eutrice. Were talking... Yes, go ahead.
Why is it that this particular program seems to have concentrated on predominantly black?
Okay. Apparently, we had still a little glitch there. Maybe the leftovers. Are we there?
I'm here. Yep, I am here.
Okay, so we're all together. I was asking, based on the named countries in the report, where there seems to be a concern as to the efficacy of this drug and the program itself in these countries. Botswana, Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Guyana, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia among them, and several Caribbean islands. It seems to me, I mean, it immediately raised my hackles because I wondered why these predominantly black countries seem to have been the concentration for the distribution of these drugs.
Well, it struck me as well. There are outbreaks of AIDS in other parts of the world, including India, I might add, and Pakistan, and even in Southeast Asian countries. I too was struck by the fact that you're talking about African countries and the Caribbean countries. I don't know. I can't read the minds of the Chai people as to why they decided to emphasize only those countries. I really cannot.
Charles Ortel, do you have, first of all, welcome. Good to have you back with us.
Thank you.
This report, it seems to me, is a blistering indictment because of what actually says that the Clinton Foundation likely increased the risk of morbidity and mortality in the distribution of these adulterated drugs.
Yeah, I mean, this is a case study, Eutrice, as we've talked about in prior programs, in why you need tight controls for any international charity. And I think that Marsha Blackburn and her staff have done a first-class job beginning to raise the awareness required for those who understand how important it is to distribute these drugs properly. I mean, there are a lot of great Great American and other charities around the world trying to do good work, particularly in Africa and in desperately poor places. And I imagine they do their best to make sure that these medicines that they distribute and the care that they offer actually are helping. Richard raises the issue, and you raised the issue of the legal structure of this charity. That's not really covered in this report. And, you know, there, you know, what you find is that when you, I mean, you know the facts. You know, Bill had to surrender his law licenses on starting January 18th or so, 2001. So he couldn't make money as a lawyer. And he should have actually disclosed that fact in these various charity things. That he was a master for all these various charities. He should have disclosed in his fundraising attempts and in the role of these charities that defect and arguably also the impeachment. But he didn't. And it came into his mind, I guess, or people close to him said, hey, you know, why don't we use this charity as sort of a calling card to do anything we may want to do, which was strictly forbidden. And so he and Ira Magaziner, the record shows, by Bill's own admission in his own book titled Giving, published September 2007, he states that he began this effort right around the time the Barcelona AIDS conference finished in 2002. That date is July 12th. And there's a rich public record, a rich vein of public record to be mined that the Clintons cannot hide because a lot of governments have tapped it out, that they started actually, surprisingly, not in Haiti, where there's a big population, or other countries in the Caribbean where there's a bigger population. They started in these tiny little countries, Bahamas, et cetera, that while they may have had and may continue to have a problem with HIV, the AIDS, this wasn't where, the first place you should have gone if you're looking at it as, you know, we got a big global problem, where do we attack first? No, they went to places where the governance is light, where it's easy to, you know, hide things, where there's chaos. And they began in places like Mozambique and, you know, other places like that. They drifted into Papua New Guinea and many other places where there is no infrastructure. There are no doctors in the bush. There's no way to check whether or not, you know, any real good is happening. And, you know, they knew because there are reports. They were involved with the government of the Bahamas issuing a report that was published, I believe, in 2002 or thereabouts. They knew then that the cost of medicine is a small portion of the total actual cost of delivering effective care. You need doctors, you need hospitals, you need all sorts of things that many of these countries didn't have. So, you know, lowering the price or contributing to lowering the price didn't necessarily do all that much for these victims, and you really needed to check what was going on. So in the first instance, between the 12th of July 2002, when they may have started, and March 23rd, 2004, there was no legal entity authorized by our IRS, as is strictly required, to, quote, fight HIV/AIDS. And the question becomes, you know, what do you mean by that? I mean, it's distributing drugs. There are a number of court cases that show that distributing drugs, even at a discount, is not necessarily a charitable activity. And there's ample precedent that shows if you want to do stuff as an American charity internationally, you must tightly control those operations. They must be pre-approved by the IRS. And that certainly didn't happen in the first period. Then they filed an application. They formed a company, Clinton HIV/AIDS Initiative, Inc., on the 24th of March, 2004, but they never, as far as we could tell in the public record, they provide no evidence that that entity, which was controlled by the main Clinton Foundation, that the Clinton Foundation had the authority at that moment in time to do any of that work. And I should add that neither Bill nor Ira were officers or directors of the Clinton Foundation through the 23rd of March, 2004. So then they set this thing up. It dabbles around. In April, they file an application. We've never seen that application. It's a technical thing called on Form 1023. But that's the controlling legal document that should be in the public domain if it was, in fact, authorized. You know, where is that document? What attachments were shown? What did they disclose about these activities? As a guess, they didn't disclose much. But again, guessing, one or more of the foreign donors, and many are mentioned in Bill's book, they include Ireland, Canada, and other governments starting in 2002 timeframe, one or more of those governments must have checked the record and said, listen, boys, if you want to do this project, you better get validly authorized. So they filed an application. They failed to disclose that as is legally required. They then filed reports for this entity in 2004 and 2005. One investigator, Jerry Corsi, found the 2004 one last year another investigator in Australia, the intrepid Michael Smith, found the 2005 one recently. You won't find them on the Clinton Foundation website. Then, in 2005, they went ahead and they claimed that at the end of the year that they'd merged this rogue entity into the parent. The merger agreement, which is not on file on the main Clinton Foundation website, is on file in the ProPublica Nonprofit Explorer and in other state places. And there you see that the I have some experience with mergers. You can see that there was no way for that merger actually to be legally perfected. But they filed it in Arkansas. The thing is, they didn't perfect it around the world, as you need to do. So then they pretended with various donors that they had the authority, and they solicited hundreds of millions of dollars. All this, by the way, is not in the report. Hundreds of millions of dollars leading up to, let's think, September 29th, 2009, when efforts began under President Obama's watch, to reorganize this Clinton Health Access into something called Clinton Health Access Initiative. Now, the application to create that entity legally, the Form 1023, is not on the Clinton Foundation website, but it is on the New York State website. And when you read it, you see it's riddled with omissions and lies. It claims that it's not a successful organization. Obviously, it's a successful organization. And, you know, we could go on and on and on about it, but this is what happens. This is why the IRS has rules that that should be enforced to tightly control these international operations, because when you don't, mayhem ensues. And I think the report suggests, you know, very clearly that what was really going on here is that the Indian generics companies and the people behind them were using this lack of controls as a means to sell suspect drugs and get cash from the U.S. and other government and others and pump up the value of their entities. The guys, two of the four major operations that sold into this mess, you know, quickly exited the scenes. Matrix at a big profit, approaching, I think, in the hundreds of millions, and Ranbaxy was sold at a profit of more than $3 billion, you know, before anybody caught on to this. So this is...
So there is an element here, then, of insider trading. These companies, and I want to go back to you, Richard, these pharmaceutical companies, which are specialists, they specialize in producing so-called generic drugs. How did this, the formation of this Clinton initiative, the Health Access Initiative, and these particular companies come together? And it seems from the report that there was a solid marketing plan. This was not just about philanthropy. This was also about cornering the market, because they had projected, for example, dealing with 33% of all cases in Africa, 95% of the cases in the Caribbean, and 85% of the cases in Asia, presumably with the same adulterated drugs. So how did this come together, and how did it work?
Well, let me just say at the beginning that in my opinion, after having read the report and done our own research, that these companies profited immensely by the endorsement of President Clinton or former President Clinton. These were small companies in India that were trying to produce generic drugs, and they were really kept out of the market by the brand name drugs. So GlaxoSmithKline, for example, had a monopoly on generic drugs. Even Teva in Israel had a market share, and these other companies really didn't have an ability to enter the market. Then when Bill Clinton conferred approval upon these companies, including Ranbaxy, they suddenly had an endorsement that gave them instant credibility, and also credibility with the United States government, because the United States government decided to buy these generic drugs through these Indian companies as a result of the Clinton Foundation conferring this kind of approval on them. And they began to expand and become, they were financially enhanced enormously to the point where many of them became actually targets by other wealthy companies to take them over. And I might add, as just an aside, not to try to overwhelm your audience here, But a person who was very close to Bill Clinton, named Rajat Gupta, was with the McKinsey Company, and he was an advisor to Ren Bakshi about how to produce a five-year plan to double to get the company to become a $5 billion powerhouse in the generic world, the generic industry world. And so they began working on that off the sort of the tailwinds of the Clinton Health Access Initiative's endorsement. And so they began to just ramp up production. And in ramping up production, it turned out the entire notion of quality assurance was lost. And in fact, there were already signs even before this that they were not really practitioners of good practice within the pharmaceutical industry to begin with. But at this point, they hired thousands of temporary workers at very low wages with very little training, and they began spewing out generic drugs that were substandard. And this got the attention of the World Health Organization and the Food and Drug Administration, and they became alarmed about it. The tragedy is that a large number of these HIV drugs were, in fact, delivered to unsuspecting people in developing countries, in poor countries, in sub-Saharan Africa, even North Africa to a certain extent, in the Middle East, and in the Caribbean. And it is a crime, in my opinion, that this was done.
But even before he left office, Bill Clinton seemed to have anticipated that he was going to head in this direction. He signed an executive order, Executive Order 13155. It was in the report I read. It was very interesting.
Yes.
Could you tell us about this particular executive order that he signed and how it factored into this massive plan to corner the market in Africa and the Caribbean?
Yes, in the last year of President Clinton's term as president, in his second term, he signed an executive order that had good intentions, but many times there are unintended consequences of it. And what he said was that he believed that there could be a waiver of third world pharmaceutical companies to have to abide by patent or what they call intellectual property rights. In other words, a company, Johnson & Johnson, makes a drug. They've created it. They have a patent, which means nobody else can produce it. Well, the president decided to relax the patent protection on HIV drugs and wanted to allow companies in the developing world and in other parts of the world to enter the market, even if they didn't have the production of quality that would assure that these drugs were safe and that they would do what they claimed they would do. He relaxed the entire regime so that companies like this, really fly-by-night companies, could now enter the terrible world of HIV and produce bogus drugs. That reduction through that executive order of the property rights and the patent rights had a serious consequence, and we're now seeing it in the possibility of harming millions of people.
But let's get something straight here, Charles. This is certainly totally illegal from the point of view of how and why the Clinton Foundation and any of the subsidiaries or affiliates that were created are concerned. The Clinton Foundation got tax-exempt status as a nonprofit organization to build a presidential library and research facility in Arkansas, Little Rock, Arkansas. That's it. Next thing you know, the president is acting almost in the capacity of the middleman in the business, trying to facilitate under the umbrella that he was doing this as part of the foundation's commitment to easing, you know, the
pain and suffering of people all over the world, which he certainly is not authorized to do. He has no authority. And in the meantime, I did not read in the report that the foundation, in distributing these drugs, had in place enough of a medical staff or medical team to consistently measure the efficacy of these drugs and to find out exactly how the patients were progressing with these drugs. So could you explain the connection between, or what you think is the connection between the Clinton Foundation branching off into all these different activities, which it is absolutely prohibited by law to do, but still getting away with it, and with such devastating consequences?
Well, of course, I am speculating because I don't actually spend much time, if any, and I probably never will spend any time talking to Team Clinton. But when you look into the public record, what you see is that the primary person who might have flagged this was inserted into the IRS, had been inserted first into the Federal Election Commission under Bill Clinton's watch, and then became head of the key department of the IRS in the tax-exempt organization, I think by July of 2001, was a very controversial person called Lois Lerner. And Lois Lerner then, in late 2005, it was announced, and in early 2006, until I think it was May of 2013, she was the head of the whole tax-exempt organization department. So I think Bill Clinton and his team knew that as far as the IRS being of a mind to go after anything Bill might do, that nothing would happen there, that there wouldn't be a decision reached to refer a prosecution to the Department of Justice. Now, I'm speculating. In terms of the Department of Justice, I don't really understand why under, the two terms of George W. Bush and under the various Republican administrations, inside the United States, different state attorneys general, I don't really understand why nobody would have noticed this. And then I think it's extremely curious, the memorandum of understanding that Richard mentioned earlier, and we talked about it before, that document that was supposed to regulate this mess was almost as if they decided, we're looking for a policeman, let's get somebody, no offense here is meant to blind and deaf people, but let's get a deaf and blind and dumb policeman and let that person try to find problems. Because the memorandum of understanding is a joke. Legally, I've had experts tell me, and I know just from my own work, the memorandum of understanding is an agreement to agree. The lies that were present on November 16th, 2008 about the true state of the foundation at that moment are obvious in the public record now. It was not a foundation in good shape. It had already then had its license to operate in the key state, Democratic-controlled state of Massachusetts, at least from the Attorney General standpoint, was revoked on March 31st, 2008. So it was a basket case in 2008. And then President Obama takes over. And then you see Eric Holder, who had been a Clinton acolyte, who served President Clinton. He had, some argue, a distaste in his mouth from the last-minute pardon of Mark Rich that occurred, I think, on the 20th of January 2001, which, there's a question mark as to who really was behind that still. Anyway, Holder's in charge of the Justice Department. Lerner's still in charge of the IRS, and it's bottled up. If there are foreign complaints about this thing, those are bottled up by the Secretary of State's operation. And, I have a suspicion that, people tell me that it's not unusual for this legal case, which I think was launched April 2007 and settled May 2013. It's not unusual for these matters to drag on, but I wonder what the Obama administration knew about this. I wonder what state regulators in the U.S. knew about it. And I think, Patrice, we've talked about this in the past. This is an area where we can agree as progressives and conservatives and neutrals, whatever, we can agree that if government is to have a role in the health business, one of the roles it should have is ensuring that, any medicine distributed inside our borders is absolutely what it's advertised to be, and, B, that any charity that dares distribute medicines outside our borders, potentially sullying the reputation of this country, potentially, as Richard says, killing people, that entity better, damn well better, have controls in place to make sure that the medicines we do distribute in the name of charity around the world are not, in fact, adulterated. And the President of the United States should have known better, and he should have spent the time and attention on this, and there better be some records that demonstrate exactly what happened here. And the people, people like PolitiFact and Anderson Cooper, who've given cover to the Clintons over the issue of whether this charity has actually helped to harm people, better now study the facts. Because the facts that I've seen that Richards reported and that Marsh Blackburn staff has put out for everybody to consider are damning. And we have more facts, and those are coming out.
I want to ask you this question, as you, and you can add your answer as you answer it.
Sure.
This relationship between Clinton and these drug companies goes back quite a few years, about 10 years or so. They wouldn't be doing this unless there was big money to be made. Where was the money coming from, and how much money so far has been accounted for or has been made by especially the Indian-based, the India-based pharmaceutical companies, and Ranbaxy in particular?
Well, Ranbaxy really cleaned up considerably. They were still a startup type of small generic company, and a few years into its operation with the Clinton Health Access Initiative, it saw that its revenues climbed to about $2 billion. But then, a few years after that, a Japanese company decided to make an offer to buy it, and they bought it for almost $5 billion. So first of all, the profiteering happened pretty quickly. And if I may just flip the coin for just one moment, Ranbaxy also gave a donation to the Clinton Foundation of between $100,000 and $250,000. Rajat Gupta, who was with McKinsey, which was advising Ranbaxy about how to go and expand its business and become a powerhouse, Rajat Gupta personally gave between $10,000 and $25,000 to the Clinton Foundation, and McKinsey, his own company, donated between $500,000 and $1 million to the Clinton Foundation. So we see a full circle. Everything's coming to a full circle here. We're seeing Chai enhance the value of a private company in India, and then that company and its advisors and allies then pay good money to the Clinton Foundation. It's a really evil circle of finance, in my opinion.
But a lot of money, nonetheless, international money, international aid, because this was lifted up by the Clinton Foundation and the Chai program as right. The centerpiece of what it was going to do. And on the basis of selling this idea, this purpose of the foundation, a lot of money poured in. So
yes.
What kind yes. of money came even from the U.S. itself?
Right. Well, I will tell you, initially, former President George W. Bush allocated $15 billion, with a B, to eradicating HIV/AIDS, particularly in Africa. And billions of dollars of that money, which was actually funneled through the U.S. Agency of International Development, billions of dollars were funneled to Ranbaxy through the federal government and through this program. Eventually, President Bush doubled that amount to $30 billion. Separately, the United Nations also purchased many of these drugs and did it through Ranbaxy, as well as foreign governments. The Norwegian government, the government in Amsterdam and the Netherlands, other governments began to pour money, open up their pocketbooks and pour money, and a large percentage of this money, billions of dollars, were funneled to Ranbaxy, who then turned around and, in my opinion, violated their solemn oath to go and help people, and they then produced low-cost, high-profit drugs that didn't work, and I think if it didn't set back people, they, according to the Securities and Exchange Commission that looked at this, and the Justice Department, that it also caused the deaths of countless people in the developing world who are counting on the Clinton Foundation and the goodwill of other governments to help them, and they were betrayed, in my opinion.
And they, these countries were specifically targeted. This program, I mean, they have to explain to me, if you're tackling AIDS, let's say, you would have a wide swath, but you are concentrating on sub-Saharan Africa. You're concentrating on Botswana, Cote d'Ivoire, Ethiopia, Guyana, Kenya, Mozambique, Namibia, Nigeria, Rwanda, South Africa, Tanzania, Uganda, Zambia, and several countries in the Caribbean. You can't blame somebody for coming to the conclusion that this is a conspiracy. You're distributing bogus drugs, and specifically in black countries. There's got to be a reason why these countries or these countries alone got these watered-down bogus drugs.
Well, I will say that there probably was a good dose of racism that was involved in this. There was also, as Charles said, many of these I think they went into countries where the governments were weak, where the laws protecting patients were weak or non-existent, where there's a great deal of corruption. But frankly, there's corruption in other countries outside of sub-Sahara Africa. You may be have hit something that may be very important, something to explore as to why they targeted these black countries. I can't give you at this point a definitive answer, but I would say that it raises a lot of questions for sure.
Charles, how does this fit in with the idea of this philanthropy, these philanthropic efforts being so monetized and leaving no room that it could be anything else but just a mad dash to the finish line, making a ton of money at people's expense?
Well, you know, it's amazing, Eutrice. That's a great question. There's a great magazine article. We've talked about it. It's referenced, I think, in the House report called Dirty Medicine. I think what we're also talking about here is dirty money. That, you know, when you look around the world, the idea of giving money selflessly, which is the definition of charity, is not exactly a new concept. You know, it's something that you could go way back into time and find philosophers of old and Greek and even earlier days wrestling with the question of, you know, what is charity? And I think the essential definition is simple. It's selfless help, loving help. And this is so far away from that. But what I think fraudsters, and I think, frankly, the team around this charity are a bunch of inveterate fraudsters to the core. One might argue that, you know, all politics is fraud, and that the fraud is omnipresent in life. But here's the case, you know, in this great country, we have literally hundreds of millions of people give away money selflessly. You know, they put cash into a tin cup thinking it's going to help a beggar. They don't ask for a tax deduction. They do it out of love and good intentions. Many of them get duped, but nonetheless, they do it. And it's not as if there's no charity anywhere in the world. I mean, there's many, many great charities. So the notion that this thing that was supposed to be a presidential archive focused on Bill Clinton's life as president might migrate into this monster around the world with no controls, by design, trustees, all insiders, no accounts, you know, no legally compliant accounts. This was a fraud by design. And there was even an article, I think, in Atlantic, not exactly a conservative magazine, titled "This Is Not Charity," in which Ira Magaziner and other people in the Clinton Foundation were willingly interviewed and bragged about the fact that this was some newfangled approach that isn't charity. Well, I mean, it's self-indicting. And how come the regulators didn't read that article then and shut it down? Because it certainly isn't charity. What it is, it's a charitable cover. You know, when the Clinton Global Initiative, until recently, you would gather together under the, you know, on a tightly restricted attendance. You'd select what media would cover the thing. And then you brag about your charitable good works. Of course, there's no controls to tell you anything about it. Then the Climate Initiative thing just gives cover for vendors to the big city mayors to get involved doing crooked deals financed by banks to sell equipment to these big cities. The HIV/AIDS thing, one thing that the report doesn't stress, this wasn't a method targeted on the cities where the populations are concentrated in all these countries. No, the Clinton Foundation targeted the rural areas in these countries. You know, I've been all over. I've been to 65 countries, many of them in Africa. And, you know, it's not so easy to get around rural Africa. So you had volunteers, in theory, distributing drugs, some professionals, but many volunteers, these remote places with no checks and no controls. And as Richard points out adroitly in his piece and the report points out, billionaires were made out of that effort. And that's strictly illegal. Strictly illegal.
Richard,
you're not
I want
supposed
to
operate a charity to make private gain.
I want to ask you, Richard, to what degree, because she was an officer of the Clinton Foundation, to what degree is Hillary Clinton culpable and liable here?
Well, it's very interesting. Charles can address this as well. But for the longest time, believe it or not, neither Bill Clinton nor Hillary Clinton were named as directors or officers in the Clinton Foundation, which is quite extraordinary because you would think that they would be the president or vice president or executive director or be an honorary trustee or a regular trustee. They kept their fingerprints off of that. Now, they got involved more fully in the Clinton Health Initiative to a certain extent. So legally, it's quite interesting, and this is where I think Charles is so helpful in letting us understand that this was an organization created without any accountability and without any sense of addressing the legal requirements of tax-exempt organizations and of charities. They were very slipshod on their paperwork, and I think that it was, in fact, to keep Bill and Hillary out of any kind of adverse legal action. That's my personal opinion. Now, when they renamed the foundation a few years ago, to the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation, all three of them got on the board of directors for the very first time. But I think in a larger sense, in a moral sense, Hillary Clinton is accountable and responsible for things that were done in her name and in which she was a very prominent supporter of the foundation. I mean, Bill and Hillary Clinton at the Clinton Global Initiative, which is their big, big meeting in New York around this time of year during the United Nations General Assembly meeting, Bill and Hillary really had one thing to give, and that was their brand name or their brand, their credibility. And so I think that Hillary and Bill are morally responsible for this, and I suspect that because the Clinton Foundation cannot be legally separated, at least in the broader interpretive sense, they are potentially legally responsible for this. And now I will tell you that I got an email yesterday from someone in Swaziland, and they are very disturbed about this story, and they are in the healthcare field dealing with HIV/AIDS patients, and they wanted to know whether there would be any possibility that they could seek compensation, financial compensation, for the harm that the foundation and Ranbaxy had put forth. Now, that's a very complicated issue, but I think that this issue will be raised in the aftermath of this very devastating congressional report.
Charles, what do you say? Is Hillary Clinton, to what extent is she liable here?
100%. So the way it works is the lawyers I have, you know, talked to about this, and you can read the statute for yourself and read the interpretive guidelines. When you set up a charity, you are legally responsible, even if you sit in the background. I mean, the people who created these charity laws were steeped in the long history of charity law and understood that this type of thing might happen and has happened in the past, that, you know, fraudsters would sit in the shadows and get dupes to go on the board and you know, serve as the target. So the legal standard that bites here is that anyone in a position to exercise significant influence over the foundation, and that would certainly be, you know, William J. Clinton and his family, were at all times and are at all times and continue to be liable for infractions here. Now, under Arkansas state law, which, you know, they might try to argue applies here, there are some limitations on liabilities of directors that are placed inside Arkansas by state law. But this has been operating internationally. So there's a variety of laws that might apply and a variety of actions that could apply here. And most of these would go through and pierce the veil. And they would say, well, listen, you know, certainly in the period after you left the White House, when you were pulling the strings and entering into memorandums of understanding around the world, Bill's signature is all over the place, you are responsible, Bill. And because you remained married to him, Hillary, you're responsible for all this. And moreover, the couple has derived direct gains of over 17.6 million from Laureate and tens of millions from speaking fees that they earned from donors to the foundation. So, you know, I think if you were to take off the Gaga glasses, which seem to force elements on the left to ignore all this damning evidence, you take those off, administer some, you know, dose of shock therapy, and then check the rules. Apply the same determination that is being applied rightly now to the Trump Foundation, and look at the facts here. These are deeply disturbing. Mr. Trump was not distributing adulterated HIV/AIDS medicine to unsuspecting people around the world who are in desperate countries and in the most remote portions of these countries, in Africa, but also in other places like Papua New Guinea and other places. And this has been going on. And, you know, and meanwhile, Bill and Hillary and Chelsea are trying to take credit for their good works. It's despicable, not deplorable.
So, Richard, you filed your story in the Daily Caller News Foundation. How do people access it? And what do you think now happens? What is supposed to happen now? Representative Blackburn has submitted the preliminary findings, supported by 64 members of Congress, wanting further investigations of this. What's the timeline for what should happen next?
Well, first of all, I think that there's going to be a number of wheels that have been triggered or placed into motion as a result of this report. As you said, the Inspector General for the Department of Health and Human Services, which has oversight over the Food and Drug Administration, will be taking a serious look at this. And the Inspector General at the State Department will also be looking at it, because USAID, the Agency for International Development, was selling these drugs or paying Ranbaxy for these drugs. But beyond that, I think that you're going to see congressional hearings. It is very possible that this could spark other legal proceedings. Let me mention one other thing, and that is in the Ranbaxy lawsuit, in which the company was fined $500 million and was barred from selling any generic drugs in the United States. That was not only taken up by the federal government, but there were about a dozen states in the District of Columbia that were parties to that, because they themselves were defrauded because they bought Ranbaxy drugs for their generic drugs for Medicaid patients in the United States. So there's a possibility that the attorney generals in many states, especially the dozen that have already been participating in the previous one, will get activated. Will any of this happen before the election? Not likely. Maybe there'll be another hearing or two, but beyond that, I think it's going to take quite a long time to unwind all of this stuff.
Richard Pollack, thank you so much for the work that you've been doing and for being with us here today. Charles, as usual, thank you so much for being our guide through this maze of corruption. And thank you for listening. Stay tuned. Coming up next, the NDC Savings Club. Let me know what you think about this program at leadstories@gmail.com. A pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. We join each other tomorrow. Bye-bye.